Welcome to Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford. Today on the show, we'll get an up-close and personal view of how life mirrors art and one woman's journey from the Greensboro Projects to an endowed university chair. It's been a long road, but Beverly MacIver has truly arrived. American maverick John Cage would have turned 100 years old this month, and Wake Forest University pianist and professor Louis Goldstein is prepared to celebrate the man and his many artistic contributions. Pianist Peter Karoff goes Baroque, Robert Moody and the Winston-Salem Symphony are set to kick off Season 66, and it'll be 17 days of artistic heaven in Greensboro with United Arts Council President Tom Fillion on the planning podium, next on Triad Arts Up Close. The Association of Retarded Citizens of Greensboro, the ARC, invites you to join them for an evening with artist Beverly MacIver on Tuesday night, October 9th at 6 o'clock in the Emerald Event Center in Greensboro. Beverly was the youngest of three daughters growing up in the Greensboro Projects in the 1970s. Much of her childhood was spent searching for acceptance, battling racism, and dealing with the sometimes aggressive behavior of her eldest sister, Renee, who was mentally disabled. Beverly's escape from the Projects came through the world of visual art, and she quickly began charting a new direction as an African-American woman artist. She now holds an endowed chair as professor of art at North Carolina Central University, the historically black university where she first learned to paint decades ago. When her mom died in 2004, Beverly agreed to become Renee's caregiver. The story of their struggles and compassion was recently made into an HBO documentary film titled Raising Renee. The DVD will be available for sale at the ARC fundraiser dinner, where Beverly will be the keynote speaker. Renee became the subject of many of Beverly's oil paintings.
Well, you know, I paint from my lived experiences, and, you know, that really started as a child growing up in Morningside homes in Greensboro. And, you know, in 1979, watching the KKK, you know, come in right out in front of our apartment complex, shoot and kill five people. And just being in the projects, you know, where it was just poor, and being bused from Morningside homes all the way across town to, you know, Kaiser and Grimsley High School, which was predominantly white and definitely middle class. So those sort of polar opposites really got me thinking a lot about, you know, who I am and how people perceive me when you're from the projects, when you're poor, when you grow up on welfare, and, you know, when trying to figure out how to get people to look at you differently, and also how to hide those things.
How do you work through that? And I'm assuming you experienced some anger or frustration during those years. How do you work through that, or do you ever?
Well, it's a lifelong process. I mean, I think when I was in high school, I worked through it by joining the clown club and putting on white grease paint and, you know, pretending, and a blonde wig, so that no one knew I was black or from the projects or, you know, that I was poor. You know, I was this cute clown, and having some kind of acceptance in that regard.
You mean literally the cute clown, or you were trying to pass, or I don't get it.
Yeah. Well, a combination of the two. I mean, I was a cute clown, and I was very nice, and people responded to me differently than they did when I was just, you know, Beverly from the project that happened to be a black female. So I got positive feedback as a white-faced clown. So, you know, for a long time, I wanted to be a professional clown. I even tried out for Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus. I got rejected from that, thank God. But, you know, for a while I thought it was going to be the way that I could make it in this world. And then I began to paint about those things, you know, like what it felt like to be a white-faced clown and have acceptance and, you know, be cute or beautiful or whatever. And then it wasn't, I saw a performance at the Duke University where all the people, the white people on stage were dressed as black clowns. And that's when it dawned on me that I could be a black clown and have this exploration of what it meant to be black in America. So I started painting about that, putting on black face paint.
Could you talk me through the stages of acceptance of Renee's situation and how that's evolved over time.
Yeah. Well, you know, I have another sister, Ronnie, who is the middle sister, and Renee's the oldest, and I am the baby. And so growing up was fairly tough because Renee was a bit violent, and, you know, she was just mean. So in any time we tried to retaliate with Renee, we would get, you know, blamed and, you know, chastised for hurting Renee, even though she really hurt us, because my mother would say, you know, she can't help it, you know, that she's like that, and shame on you. So there was this, you know, this horrible inequity that happened growing up with not being able to defend yourself and having this person who could just be mean. And as a child, not really understanding that, you know, it was because she was on too much medication, you know, hormones, whatever, that was causing a lot of her behavior problems. But then as I got to be an adult, you know, I would hang out with Renee. I mean, a lot of the time I was away in college or teaching in another state. But as adults, you know, we became friends, and, you know, my mom asked if I would be willing to take care of her if something should happen to my mom. And I said, sure, just sort of thinking that my mother would never die and live forever, or that I would be rich enough that I could pawn the responsibility off to a caretaker in some way, that it would never really be an issue. But that's not what happened. My mom died fairly suddenly of pancreatic cancer in 2004, and Renee was waiting for me to come and pick her up. So, again, at the time I was living in New York because I had that studio space, and decided that I couldn't take care of Renee in New York. So I left New York and I went back to Arizona, where I was teaching at Arizona State, and brought Renee with me. That's when we began to live together. That was about 5 or 6 years ago.
Okay. Yeah, under already strenuous circumstances and then the loss of your mom on top of that. Beverly, what fears did you have going into that arrangement? And I want to know also about what you've learned about yourself and Renee since then.
Well, the fear is, you know, I don't have children except for my lovely cats. And while they are well-behaved, lovely cats, you know, they are cats. And that's my only experience with, you know, raising anybody. So, yeah, I didn't have any experience. And I didn't have any role models really to look to because I was out in Arizona by myself, basically. And, you know, I had my art career and I was traveling a lot. And so it became challenging to take care of Renee.
For me, it was interesting that she's such a focal point of so much of your art. And I'm wondering if that ties into how you, I mean, your relationship has evolved since that initial pairing.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, like I said, I paint about whatever's happening in my head. And so Renee was occupying a lot of space in my head in terms of, you know, just caretaking for her. Like, you know, okay, she has to eat. She really eats 3 meals a day, for real. And preparing meals and, you know, taking her clothes out and making sure that they match. And just, you know, things that moms do. So it was a lot of work. And I think it did spill over definitely into my artwork and comparing myself to my mother. You know, I mean, really sort of remembering that my mother did this with great ease and that, you know, I was struggling and, you know, perhaps being a little bit too hard on myself because it wasn't, you know, coming so natural, I should say. But, you know, now, I mean, I've learned so much from Renee about compassion. I mean, she really is, I think, the only person on this earth that just loves me unconditionally, you know, like would follow me to the end of the world. And, that, you know, what a wonderful feeling to know that, you know, you have at least one person that just adores you that much.
Some of the images look like direct representations. Others are slightly distorted. How does that come about? I've always wondered that about artists in general, I have to confess, where you could do a representational piece of artwork that would be vivid in an almost Wyeth sort of exact representation, and others certain features are distorted and others. What goes into that decision making?
I am, first of all, very intuitive. And when I paint, you know, I usually don't know what I'm going to paint. I mean, I usually, you know, go in the studio and basically what comes up comes out. And sometimes that's really difficult and daunting to me because, you know, I might be fine on the outside consciously, and then inside I might be, you know, breaking apart and not really be aware of that consciously yet. And then the painting will come and it might start to break apart. And then, you know, my idea is I always say to myself, you know, well, if you really want to know how you're feeling right now, you know, do a self-portrait. And most of the time, it's like, oh, my God, I didn't realize I was that depressed.
I think that's really interesting. I've always been fascinated with the study or science. Lots of naysayers out there, but I've always been intrigued by the science of handwriting. You can tell so much about an individual just looking at how they write. It is very revealing in some ways.
It is.
Your use of light is just incredible. I'm struck by the fact that so many of these backgrounds are very dark, and then you've got this explosion of colors, many, many colors, representing, again, mostly portraits here that I'm looking at, kind of dovetailing our conversation early on about the white face and black face stuff. I find that really interesting.
Yeah, well, you know, people say to me when I show up at openings, they say, oh, you made those colors up that are in your face. And I always say to them, no, I didn't. I said I actually saw those colors. And they're like, yeah, right. No one ever believes me, but it's true, you know. And I always try to make the background color sort of a supportive color that's going to recede back in space and not try to come forward and compete with what's going on in the foreground, because I want that face, that image, that portrait of myself or Renee to be in your face. And I want that head to be bigger than life. I really didn't start painting until I went to undergraduate at North Carolina Central University. And I took a painting class, and I happened to have a great teacher, Elizabeth, you know, who just said, you know, golly, you could be really good at this. If you keep working hard, you could be really good at this. And I just took her at her word, you know, because I wanted to get out of the projects. And I needed something that I was good at to get me out of there, since I had failed at clown college. So, you know, this painting thing was like, she said I could be good at it. Okay, I'm going to give it my all. And that's exactly what I did. And I went to graduate school and, you know, and then I just started listening to myself and being in touch with my intuition. You know, and trusting what came up, even when it scared me or even when I didn't know what it was or how to do it. And so the combination of just learning, you know, some real traditional skills, paint application, you know, I always wanted my paintings to look like the paint, to look like icing on a cake, to be creamy enough that the viewer would want to lick it but not do that. And, you know, sometimes I'm talking about some pretty difficult issues, and I thought, well, if I could make them beautiful, especially around Renee and disability or around depression, if I could make the paint application beautiful, then somebody might look at it more before they realize that, you know, they're looking at someone with a disability. You know, as people begin to live longer, the likelihood that all of us will experience some form of caretaking is very high. And, you know, you think about when you are having to take care of somebody and there's no break, you know, the ARC will provide a respite. That means a night off. You know, they take the person, you know, take them to the movies or whatever. And you get to do whatever you want. And how important, I mean, it sounds like not much, but it's so significant, you know, to have that time to oneself to replenish. And so these programs are extremely important, and we have to support them for the people, you know, who are part of the ARC, but also because the likelihood that the next generation will be taking care of someone is very high.
My thanks to artist and North Carolina Central University Professor of Art, Beverly McIver. Since 2004, she's been the primary caregiver of her sister Renee, who is mentally disabled. Together with the board of directors of the ARC of Greensboro, they'd like to invite you to an evening with artist Beverly McIver on Tuesday night, October 9th at 6 o'clock in the Emerald Event Center in Greensboro, where Beverly will be the keynote speaker. The ARC of Greensboro promotes and protects the human rights of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. They actively support their full inclusion and participation in the community throughout their lifetimes. And you'll find links to more information on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. This is Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford. John Cage was an astonishing individual. His compositions upended long-held conventions about the listening process and prodded us to reevaluate how we define not only music, but the entire experience of encountering art. So wrote Wake Forest University professor and pianist Louis Goldstein. His Cage Fest opens Friday, September 28th and concludes November 13th on the Wake Forest University campus. The festival celebrates what would have been Cage's 100th birthday with a variety of fascinating lectures, recitals, exhibits, and other performances, beginning with Musa Circus from 5 to 7 o'clock in the Z. Smith Reynolds Library Atrium on the Wake Forest University campus. It's a free concert that's open to the public, where any individual or ensemble is asked to share their performance. So try something new. Bring your musical talents and get ready to perform. John Cage had a huge impact on American composers, and Cage Fest will feature performances of many of his most important works by some of the world's leading Cage interpreters, including festival organizer, pianist, and Wake Forest University professor Louis Goldstein, and internationally acclaimed pianist Stephen Drury. But Louis is hoping that Cage Fest shines a light on the lesser-known but equally important other artistic contributions made by his hero, John Cage.
Several years ago, it occurred to me that today's young people don't know who John Cage was. I'm not criticizing the current generation. They know other things. And I don't like to say when I was in college, but when I was in college,
you're losing me now.
John Cage was an important cultural figure. He was well known, not necessarily to music students. In fact, maybe less so to music students. But he was associated with Marshall McLuhan, who came up with the phrase "global village." That was a new idea in the 1960s. Cage was associated with Buckminster Fuller, who described a new concept, spaceship Earth. This is just to say that Cage was well known as a cultural personality. And when he was invited to speak at Oberlin College.
Were you at Oberlin then?
Yes. Graduated in 1970.
Okay.
As he was invited to speak at colleges all over the country. His topic at the time was anarchy. He was interested in the political concept of anarchy. I wish he would have come up with a different word for that, because his vision that he called anarchy really is a lot like utopia. Hmm. It's simply a lack of government, no government, people in an area deciding how their lives would be lived by calm conversations with each other, which would constantly be renegotiated because people change.
That's pretty diametrically opposed to the initial connotation of anarchy,
yes,
for most. Sitting in the audience listening to this guy speak, what was your reaction to that lecture?
My mouth was open. My jaw was on my chest. I didn't know what to make of it. I thought that he came to Oberlin to speak about music. I was in a group that had prepared a performance for him of Imaginary Landscape Number 4, which is the piece for 12 radios that requires 24 players because one person can't control both the volume and the frequency dial. The score is so complicated. He listened to it and then started talking about anarchy. He didn't say thank you. It appeared that he was just putting up with it. It was something that he had to tolerate in order to get the floor to talk about what he wanted to talk about. Another superficial impression I have, which somehow seems important to me, even though it is superficial, he was a chain smoker for a lot of his life. And he was smoking in this room in 1968 Oberlin had some brand new buildings, and the idea of not allowing smoking inside of a building was a new idea at the time. So he was standing in this very nice little auditorium smoking. There was no ashtray. He looked around for an ashtray before he started talking. Couldn't find one. Somebody started to get up and go out of the room to find something for him to use, and he said, "Oh, never mind. I'll use this paper bag," which sounds like a joke. You can't use paper to put out something that's burning. He said it without a smile, without a laugh, and he proceeded, as he talked, to use the paper bag so carefully that it worked as an ashtray. So this idea that seemed comic, seemed like a joke on the surface, actually was something practical. And for me, that's been an emblem of a lot of his ideas that sound absurd on first hearing. And then turns out that there's thought behind it and reasons, and they really amount to something substantial.
That's pianist and Wake Forest University professor Louis Goldstein. He's celebrating the artistic contributions made by John Cage over 6 weeks of Cage Fest on the Wake Forest University campus. There'll be lectures, recitals, exhibits, dance, and music circus, which begins the festival on Friday, September 28th at 5 o'clock in the Z. Smith Reynolds Library on the Wake Forest University campus. Bring your instruments, voice, and drums and get set to perform. It's all about participation as we salute this great American composer and thinker on what would have been his 100th birthday. Anyone can play, and all musicians are encouraged to participate. No registrations required. After this short break, we'll get a Cage Fest sneak preview with more of my conversation with Louis Goldstein. Stay with us. Welcome back to Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford. Cage Fest is a 6-week celebration of the music, poetry, art, dance, politics, and more of American maverick John Cage. Some of the world's leading Cage scholars and performers will visit the Wake Forest University campus to share their knowledge. The event begins September 28th. It's free and open to the public, and it's being organized by acclaimed pianist and Wake Forest University professor Louis Goldstein. Here's part two of our conversation. How do you begin to map out a festival that touches on so many aspects of his life, or I guess winnowing it down to the most crucial in your mind?
Yes. I started with a rather small idea. I wanted the Department of Music at Wake Forest to sponsor Steve Drury to give a guest recital.
The great pianist, champion of many modern works, as well as the literature from Beethoven and beyond. But
yes, I really believe that he is a artist series caliber pianist who we are lucky to get on the music department budget this year. My reason for suggesting Steve Drury for this particular year was because it is the centennial birthday of John Cage. When that came through, I thought, well, maybe this can be something bigger. So I looked to other aspects of Cage's creativity, speaking with Paul Bright, who was about to become the director of the Haynes Art Gallery in the Scales Fine Arts Center. He said that he would be interested in having a gallery show of Cage's work. So that idea took flight with that conversation. I knew that Marjorie Perloff was a highly respected literary critic who took Cage seriously as a poet. I contacted her thinking that because she's famous and lives in California, that this was a long shot. But she responded immediately and said, "I would love to come and talk about Cage as a poet." So that established music, poetry, and art, his visual art. It was easy to supplement that program with a couple of musicologists. David Patterson is a musicologist who has specialized in the early part of Cage's career. He will be here in November. Rob Haskins is a musicologist who has specialized in Cage's late music. And he will be here in October, both as a lecturer and a performer. He's also a pianist, and he and I together are going to perform one of Cage's last compositions. The title is 2-2. So, that's music, art, and poetry. Through Rob Haskins, I came in contact with an art critic named Kay Larson. Kay Larson is also a Buddhist who takes Cage seriously as a Zen adept. Cage was not actually a Buddhist, but he was so enthralled with aspects of that philosophy, so well studied in it for half of his life. It was not a fleeting interest, but half of his life he was absorbed in this. And many of the Buddhist ideas he studied infected his own personal thought and became part of his own set of ideas. Kay Larson published a book this summer called Where the Heart Beats. It is, in effect, a biography of Cage, and it is a very good biography of the first half of his life. But also points out along the way several small incidents that could have primed the young John Cage to be so receptive to Zen Buddhism when he encountered it in his 40s. Kay Larson will be here. She's the last speaker in the series, and she is going to speak on Cage and his relationship with Zen. David Patterson, by the way, is going to speak on Cage and politics.
After our anarchy conversation?
Yes. Cage had a spottier record with his political ideas than he did with other things. There are things to criticize about his relation to politics, his political ideas. But that's going to be discussed in one lecture. And the first lecture will be by Bruce Butler, who is the chair of the philosophy department at UNC Asheville. His topic is going to cover Buckminster Fuller and a philosopher named Richard Rorty and John Cage, how the three of them relate to each other.
Yeah, philosophy is such a huge part of Cage's life and thought. It seems like just as interesting as the objects and sounds that he created was the underpinnings, the intellectual underpinnings or philosophy behind it.
He was an artist who was stimulated by philosophical ideas. I think it's a mistake to call Cage a philosopher. I don't think he operates like the kind of scholastic person we normally associate as being a philosopher. But he was definitely someone who was interested in philosophical thought and influenced by it in his own creative work.
Modern dance, another area in the arts that was strongly impacted by John Cage. How's that going to be represented?
Yes, and impacted primarily through his relationship with Merce Cunningham. They were personal partners for 40 years or so, and also artistic partners. They saw eye to eye about how to structure their separate disciplines. Dance in this particular series of programs is going to be represented by a new choreography by our dance professor here at Wake Forest, Christina Soriano. She has made a dance with a student of hers named Cynthia Wang. It's a solo dance. Cynthia is going to dance it. It is based on Cage's life and his ideas, and it uses Cage's music. So it's called Dancing Cage, and it is very tightly bound up in all aspects of Cage's career. That's going to be performed on October 30th, actually in the gallery, in the Haynes Gallery, as part of the opening celebrations for the art exhibit of Cage's works, which is titled Cage Rocks. The title actually means something other than Cage was a great guy. Most of the works that are going to be on display involve tracings of rocks, which is something that he was involved with ever since his discovery of the Zen garden in Kyoto called Ryoanji. And in these works, you'll see a lot of rock tracings. That's one of the tools he used to make these particular works. The opening celebration for this show will include the kickoff event for the new University Center interdisciplinary place. It will have the Dancing Cage performance by Cynthia Wang and an opening lecture by Ray Cass. Ray Cass is an artist and a writer who facilitated a lot of Cage's last visual works. He runs the Mountain Lake Workshop, which is in Virginia. And several times in the last five or so years of his life, Cage spent a week or two there making prints and also watercolors.
I'm just really impressed, Louis, with all these principal players in Cage's life and the amount of interaction that's gone on between him and some of these people. What do you hope the takeaway is for the person who experiences one or any of these events coming up during Cage Fest?
Well, I think all of them individually will be very interesting. So a person who can come to only one lecture or only one concert, I think will be able to enjoy that and learn something from it. For people who can come to more than one, several, maybe all, the effect should be just an expansion of whatever mental territory Cage occupies in their minds. He is, if he is known to anyone today, it is usually as a composer, secondarily as somebody involved with dance. But someone who can experience an esteemed literary critic talking about his poetry, someone who has researched his life with Buddhism talking about that, and seeing the art show that will be in the Haynes Gallery. Who knows?
My thanks to pianist and Wake Forest University professor Louis Goldstein. Cage Fest kicks off Friday, September 28th at 5 o'clock at the Z. Smith Reynolds Library Atrium on the Wake Forest University campus with Musa Circus. It's a free and open-to-the-public performance, so try something new, bring your musical talents, and get ready to perform. It's all about participation as we salute this great American composer, John Cage, on what would have been his 100th birthday. Anyone can play, and all musicians are encouraged to participate. No registrations required. You'll find links to the complete Cage Fest schedule at wfdd.org/triadarts. Well, we're going to take a short break, but there's more music to come on the second half of the show. We'll have Karoff at the keyboard and the best of the Baroque. Robert Moody will talk us through the first concert of the Winston-Salem Symphony's 66th season, and United Arts Council of Greater Greensboro's Tom Fillion is here for 17 days. Next, when Triad Arts Up Close continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford, and this is Understanding Classical Music, with our good friend Peter Karoff at the keyboard.
Today I'd like to talk about a wonderful period in music history we call the Baroque era. Dates from about, 1600 to about 1750 or so. Some of the greatest composers that we know date from this time, including Johann Sebastian Bach, George Friedrich Handel, obscure Italian guy called Vivaldi. Now, in general, music from the Baroque era tended to favor a procedure called counterpoint, a musical texture, let's say, where there's lots and lots of melodies going on at the same time. For example, if you hear a melody coming in like this, odds are you're going to hear the same melody a little bit lower coming in like this, and layered on top of the first melody. So that's counterpoint, not just one melody, but two melodies or three melodies or four melodies going on at the same time. And you find this all over the place in Baroque music. Another characteristic of music in this time frame is ornamentation. The spirit of ornamentation pervades this music. Now, what's ornamentation? Well, simply put, the notes on the page aren't always what you play. If you just see, say, three notes, you wouldn't be expected to simply play those, but you'd be expected to add some little ornaments, some little trills, some little extra things thrown in. And so, for example, in a piece like this, you might be expected to go. So there's a real spirit of kind of freedom in this kind of music, almost like jazz. It's interesting because even though in this time you have lots of very rigorous counterpoint, lots and lots of melodies going on at the same time, which you might think is a very kind of mathematical and intellectual way to approach music, at the same time you have this spirit of freedom, spirit of improvisation, where you're expected to throw in all kinds of extra stuff more or less at the spur of the moment. Now, it's difficult to talk about Baroque music without mentioning an instrument that pervades all of this, all of the music of this period. And that instrument isn't the one I've been playing, the piano, but rather its precursor, the harpsichord. And I just happen to have a harpsichord sitting right here, so let me show you some of the differences between the harpsichord and the piano. You know, the piano makes it sound when a little hammer hits the string, whereas in the harpsichord, what happens is a string is sitting there and there's no hammers involved. A little piece of quill, a little plectrum, as it's called, goes right by the string and plucks it. So you get this distinctive, almost guitar-like sound. Now, this fact of its being plucked instead of struck not only accounts for the sound quality of it, what it sounds like, but it also accounts for the fact that the harpsichord doesn't go loud or soft, depending on how hard or soft I can hit the key. I'm going to hit this key very gently now. And now with all my strength, I'm going to hit it really hard. And you can see there's no difference at all. A little bit of music trivia here. The reason the piano is called the piano is it used to be called the pianoforte, the soft loud. In fact, it used to be called il clavicembalo che si può suonare pianoforte, the harpsichord that you can actually play soft and loud. It's, as we would say today, touch sensitive, whereas the harpsichord was not. Now, it's limited in terms of its dynamic capabilities. You can't go loud and soft by how hard or gently you push the key, but it has other capabilities. It's very crisp in its attack by just the nature of what it does. So it has a nice sort of impact, and it's wonderful in Baroque orchestras. And also, it's very well suited to lots of improvisation. In fact, much harpsichord music just presumes and expects that you're going to not just say what's on the page, but fill in all sorts of harmonies. Roll the chords. And throw in trills. So Baroque music is very exciting, very energetic. It's often filled with melodies running in opposite directions, three, four, five, six melodies at once. Lots of fun to hear some of the greatest composers in music history from this time creating this wonderful spirit in this period we call the Baroque era.
Steinway artist and Wake Forest University professor Peter Karoff at the keyboard. This is Triad Arts Up Close, and from the piano bench now to the conductor's podium. On Friday night, September 21st at 7:30, the Winston-Salem Symphony's principal oboist will sound the tuning A to open the orchestra's 66th season. This year's 2012-2013 Classic Series concert opens in the Stevens Center with Beethoven's dramatic Leonore Overture No. 3. It'll be followed by renowned violinist Jennifer Koh and her interpretation of the violin concerto by Jan Sibelius. The Symphony No. 3 by Aaron Copland concludes the program. The same program repeats on Sunday afternoon, September 23rd at 3 o'clock, and you can enjoy a slightly abbreviated performance on Saturday during the Winston-Salem Symphony's Kicked Back Classic Series. Robert Moody will lead the orchestra in all three concerts. Bob's now in his eighth season as music director of the Winston-Salem Symphony. He recently stopped by WFDD to talk about the program.
This is the 66th season for the symphony and my eighth as music director. Hard to believe.
My, how time does fly.
Yeah, I've actually begun sketching out my 10th anniversary season, and it's really odd to write that down and think about that. Yeah. It's exciting, but yeah, it's great to now look back over a lot of wonderful success and what a chapter in the history of the symphony that I'm extremely proud of these last 7 years.
And now when you look forward and you're plotting out this this coming season, if it's already happened, obviously, what do you draw from your now years of experience in putting together programs for an entire season?
Well, I'll tell you what I have come to understand, and that is that as you program for an orchestra, you're really programming for the personality of a community. I think in the very beginning, I was programming based simply on my own personality. As I got to know the orchestra and we collectively develop a personality on stage, that was sort of the next phase of programming. I began to program for the personality of Robert Moody and the Winston-Salem Symphony, those 80 players together. And now I'm actually realizing that it goes beyond that. It's us plus the community. It's those who are involved in the active participation, listening, supporting the great music. And you don't just give the community, quote unquote, what they want. You grow the community based on understanding who they are. And that's been really enjoyable for me.
Let's dive into the program then.
Cool.
For the 66th season for the Winston-Salem Symphony. A great program to kick things off. Beethoven, Sibelius, and Copland. First, the Leonore Overture, number 3. A lot of overtures from this guy. Where's the opera? Tell us a story about Beethoven and opera.
Well, Beethoven, I hold, was a brilliant writer for the human voice. And some of his most spectacular works are for the human voice, even though he challenges the voice. I mean, a lot of his writing is quite high, but nonetheless, Beethoven, I think, was such a singing composer. I mean, I say that to say that of all the vocal works that he created, he actually wrote only one opera, Fidelio, and he struggled mightily with how to begin the opera, and the music from this opera was a struggle for him, and he went through several incarnations. We are the grateful recipient of that, because now there are multiple works which behave or behaved as overtures to Fidelio. And the most famous of all of those is now thought of as Leonora No. 3. It's the sort of, I think, greatest encapsulation of Beethoven's writing in a symphonic orchestral way. And I will say also in a vocal way, because there is this fanfare singing trumpet that heralds in the season for us.
And from Beethoven to an amazing showpiece for the violin in the hands of Jan Sibelius.
Yeah, and I think that Sibelius has an extreme power in taking you to his landscape, I would say more quickly than just about any composer I can think of. If you think about Finlandia, you realize that very quickly you're transported, so to speak, to the ice and the starkness and the vastness and the fjords and the landscape of Sibelius's home, Finland. That's so true in this violin concerto. Jenny Koh, who is playing with us, who's one of my favorite violinists on the planet. I've had the chance to work with her before, playing a Saint-Saëns violin concerto, now Sibelius. And Jenny has said of this work that the strength in it is in bringing out sort of that stark landscape, as opposed to sort of plowing through it like yet another late 19th century romantic work, to find this vastness of the piece and this expanse of the work and this landscape is amazing. For the listener to find this while enjoying one of the finest violinists who happens to be playing today with the technical virtuosity needed for this piece, the combination is jaw-dropping.
The last work in the program is by arguably this country's greatest composer, Aaron Copland. What makes Aaron Copland so great?
Well, when I think about American composers, I always think about the words that Anthony Dvorak gave to young composers when he came to America in the early 1890s. He came here and young American composers were trying desperately to sound like Brahms and Wagner and Dvorak. And Dvorak said to them, "Stop reaching to the European soil. Instead, reach into your own soil. Dig into the soil of America." And he specifically, in the late 1890s, referenced old slave spirituals and Native American music. Well, it's truly that comment that began to get people moving. And from that, pretty soon after, came a Joplin and then a Gershwin and absolutely a Copland. And so Copland looks to the American soil. He paid a lot of attention to the hymn tunes and the camp songs that people were singing in America. Names like Cowboys and Shakers, and this kind of music was clearly different than Brahms or Wagner. He made this so completely American, consciously to the world when, during the Second World War, he created what has become one of the most famous American tunes of all time, The Fanfare for the Common Man, which has become almost one of our anthems. So 1942, Fanfare for the Common Man, the war has ended, 1946, 1947, Copland's working on a symphony, and he does what other great composers have done. He writes a work that is sort of an investment in kind of a chaotic journey. A search goes on in the first, second, and third movements. Suddenly, the fourth movement begins, and we hear not the brass from 1942, but we hear two flutes. And then it moves us to what we know. People take us through sort of a world of exploration, a world of a bit of chaos, and you don't know where the tonality is going. It's a little hard to tell where the melodic structure is going. That sort of closes you up. It's sort of, you feel the pressure of that, and then the release of that tension. And it's such a releasing experience. I love this piece. You just got to hear it live.
Winston-Salem Symphony music director Robert Moody. This year's 2012-2013 Classic Series concert marks the symphony's 66th season, and it begins Friday night, September 21st at 7:30 in the Stevens Center. Music by Beethoven, Sibelius, and Copland on the program. If you can't make Friday's performance, there's a Kicked Back Classics concert on Saturday night at 7:30 and a repeat of Friday's performance on Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock. You'll find links to ticket information and more on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. This is Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford, and we're off to Greensboro for 2.5 weeks of arts that you don't want to miss out on. On Friday night, September 9th, the United Arts Council of Greater Greensboro and its many partners will kick off 17 days with a big block party, and from there it's 17 days filled with amazing theater, visual art, music, and dance. Moving beyond traditional arts will be celebrations of Native American heritage, the 150th birthday of O. Henry, and a Chocolate Lover's Weekend. More than 130 events in all, and you'll find the complete calendar on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. In the meantime, here's UAC President and CEO Tom Fillion and Chef Lee Hessling.
135 events, September 21 through October 7th. Music, theater, dance, visual arts, spoken word, history, mystery, and chocolate.
See, I was going to fill in that blank. Perfect segue. Thank you. And Lee's here from Proximity and
Green Valley Grill.
It's a 5-course meal you'll be preparing?
Yeah, 5-course meal, and chocolate features as a component in every course. So savory and sweet. It's really slick.
Yeah. Chocolate's, as if there was such a thing, a renaissance for chocolate, but it seems to be on a lot of minds these days.
Well, you know, there's a lot of health benefits with chocolate that people choose to believe.
Yeah, right.
Like, and want to believe.
And want to believe, that's right. And, you know, let's face it, it tastes fantastic. So people don't realize, a lot of folk don't realize, you know, what kind of applications it can have in a savory component. It adds so much depth of flavor in a savory kind of setting.
I'm a big fan of mole sauce.
There you go. That's a perfect example of it.
As an example, I love Mexican food. What's a common misuse of chocolate when amateurs are trying to bring that into their cooking? Or even when professionals, you go to a restaurant and, ooh, that's not quite hitting the mark.
That's a perfect question. It's the overuse of the chocolate. When you're using it in a savory application, you got to know when enough's enough. You don't want it to be too sweet and overpowering. The chocolate should complement what you're using.
That's what I love when it's subtle. Hot chocolate is really nice.
There you go.
It's the hint of that and a little cinnamon. Oh, boy. We're all drooling here in the studio. But let's get into the various courses now for September 28th. And at the Proximity.
Yeah, well, you know, we're going to start with the passing hors d'oeuvres. I'd say the star of that little lineup is a chocolate bacon brioche slider.
Slider.
Oh, yeah.
Bacon,
so, you know, we had to put bacon in there somewhere.
Bacon. I can imagine those would pair really well. A little salt, a little chocolate, a little sweet.
That's exactly right. You know, a little buttery brioche roll. Yum, right?
Wow.
And then, you know, we roll into the first course, which is a raspberry bib salad with dark chocolate shavings and golden raspberry vinaigrette.
Wow. Lee's supposed to bring these food items here and prepare it for us on the show, and then I get to taste everything.
Would have been so much more effective, right?
Okay, it's tough to recreate the Julia Child's magic without any images.
The next course, and brace yourself, this may be my fave, is a chili lime seared scallop with a white chocolate beurre blanc. So beurre blanc is a really fancy name for butter sauce for for those who don't know.
I was wondering, when you said scallop, I was wondering how you're going to bring chocolate into that. But then when you go to white chocolate, no competition with the subtle flavors of the scallop.
That's exactly right. And, you know, white chocolate has that velvety mouthfeel. Butter sauce has that velvety mouthfeel. So it's a smashing combination with that, I'll call it a sexy, you know, mouthfeel of a scallop.
Sure. I got to ask, though, how do you come up with that? Or is that, was that, be honest, is this one of your mom's old recipes? Or did you invent this yourself?
Now, I will say mom has always been an inspiration. But, you know, it's one of those things, you know, I have these R&D moments back there in the kitchen where, I thankfully have the time and ability to do that. And we just kind of put flavors together. And you know, you can already imagine in your mind what things taste like. And white chocolate and scallop just kind of, the textural things made it pop. You know, that's what made me think of it.
Now, after the scallops then, how do we round things out?
After the scallops, we're going to have a cocoa-dusted Wagyu short rib.
Wagyu short ribs, new to me. What's a Wagyu?
So Wagyu is a species of cow. Okay, You've probably heard of Kobe beef.
Yes.
Okay. Well, Kobe cattle are Wagyu is the breed, and okay. Kobe is the region. So that's how that kind of became famous. But they're raising Wagyu cattle now all over the world. They're not Kobe. They're Wagyu. And so I braised that short rib in some red wine and 11 secret herbs and spices. And then when it comes out of the braising liquid, I have a cocoa and brown sugar mixture that I just kind of roll the short rib in.
Oh, boy, that sounds great. And then for dessert, a Hershey bar.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Some more,
Well, you know, I can't talk about dessert because that is a surprise.
Wonderful. And then the following day, those in attendance or those not get a chance to learn how to create some of these things on their own.
That's right. The following day, in case you hadn't had enough chocolate on day one, day two is a chocolate-inspired cooking class. You know what? I'll call it more of a cooking show. You know, it's not a hands-on thing. You don't get your hands dirty, so you can kick back and kind of enjoy the learning process.
Doesn't sound like any fun at all. Great. Well, thanks, Lee. So, believe it or not, 17 days is even more than chocolate, as in dance, as in art, as in opera, and lots of music. Should we dive into the music first?
Sure. Probably one of the biggest events we're presenting this year is on September 24th. Branford Marsalis and Joey Calderazzo, his pianist, are coming as part of their duo tour. Saxophone and piano. We're doing it at Triad Stage, which is only, just a little under 300 seats, very intimate space.
Amazing.
And we're very excited about that.
For non-jazzers or just jazz likers but not lovers, I mean, Branford Marsalis, you remember that name? Well, he is definitely of the Marsalis family. In fact, he and his brother Winton played in the great Art Blakey band to get their start, went as a duo and then their separate ways, but they're two of the leading jazz musicians in the world. And Branford now, a member of our fair state, right? He lives in the Durham area. And Joey Calderazzo, I first saw him when he was 19 playing with Michael Brecker in Chicago. I mean, the guy's one of the most amazing pianists out there today. They're both here in our great state. And to see them in that venue, that's just freakish. What a treat.
We've got so many other things. Weatherspoon has 5 exhibits going on throughout the time of the festival.
Uh-huh.
We have a block party on First Friday, October 5th, with Red Oak, featuring Red Oak lagers and very great stuff. And this incredible band called Lake Street Dive, which is a mostly acoustic, kind of groove-driven indie pop band. And first time they've ever been in Greensboro, and the buzz is fantastic. They have an incredible female lead vocalist, a lead guitar player who puts it down and plays trumpet on some of the tunes, and hot drummer and an acoustic bass player who's played with a bunch of different bands. Just another wonderful evening on Friday, October 5th, and we're expecting thousands of people.
Let me clear space for you to sit beside me. You don't need your back against the wall.
One thing I love about just looking through the brochure now, the variety of performances here, and going from indie rock to Cora is a fantastic leap and one of the best players in the world today.
We're bringing in Mamadou Diabaté to play on Saturday, September 29th. Cora player, 21-stringed instrument that sounds like a harp or sounds like a flamenco guitar or sounds like Delta blues guitar. I mean, it's all over the place depending upon how he plays it. Storyteller, a wonderful family event on Saturday the 29th. Lots of other great things. The Greensboro Opera is collaborating with UNCG Opera Theater to produce an evening of opera highlights. That's going to feature some UNCG alums who have graced the stage of the Met, New York City Opera, Glimmerglass, kind of bringing some of the best of a really great collection of alums back to UNCG to sing that evening.
My thanks to United Arts Council of Greater Greensboro President and CEO Mr. Tom Fillion and Chef Lee Hessling. 17 Days kicks off on Friday, September 21st, with 5 big events, and then the music continues this month with special performances by the Greensboro Opera and UNCG Opera Theater. It's an evening of opera highlights. Then Dmitri Sitkovetsky celebrates his birthday during 17 Days with a concert titled Viennese Gala and his performance of the Brahms Violin Concerto. The Harlem Quartet comes to Greensboro for a concert at UNCG and a 2-day residency, and much more. But there's lots more than music during 17 Days. Human Rights Watch takes their film series on the road, and 17 Days in Greensboro is their first stop. There will be a special O. Henry 150th birthday celebration dinner for Greensboro's native son. And in dance, Van Dyke Dance Group will perform a world premiere, and former Alvin Ailey principal Dwayne Cyrus will choreograph a program as part of the festival as well. 17 Days celebrates Hispanic Heritage Month with a special event at the Empire Ballroom, and with more than 130 different events, over 60% of which are free and open to the public. For 17 Days details, wfdd.org/triadarts. Well, that's all for today's program. Our assistant producers this week were Eddie Garcia, Marion Wilson, and WFDD intern Natalie Barrett. You'll find podcasts of this program as well as past episodes on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. You can send your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. I'm David Ford. Thanks for joining me today for Triad Arts Up Close.